Welcome to Dialogue Unbound. I'm Margaret Olsen Hemming.
And I'm Caroline Klein. Today, we're talking about some new statues of Jesus Christ at Temple Square. The church revealed these statues in the spring of this year. And for this episode, we want to talk specifically about two striking bronze sculptures that depict Christ in moments of suffering, one in Gethsemane and one carrying the cross on his way to Calvary. The church describes them as depicting transcendent moments in Christ's life and ministry. They were created by artists Michael Hall and husband and wife team Stephanie and Roger Hunt. They are very different from the Christ statues the LDS Church has displayed in the past, particularly the Christus statue by Danish artist Bertel Thorvaldsen. While the Christus statue presents a triumphant Christ, these new statues depict a Christ in agony.
So I'm just going to say right at the outset that Caroline and I have very different reactions to these statues. In fact, we strongly disagree about them. So part of this conversation is going to be about whether there is value in religious art that shows a suffering Christ. What does it do to our theology when we see Jesus not as the triumphant, resurrected figure of the familiar Christus, but as someone exhausted, anguished, even tortured, and carrying the instrument of his own execution? So to help us think about these perspectives and these questions, we have two guests with very different backgrounds.
Jenny Champeau is the director of the Book of Mormon Art Project and has spent years thinking about how visual art shapes the way Latter-day Saints read scripture and understand their faith. She's also the co-author, among several other books, of Picturing Christ, Understanding Depictions of Jesus in History and Art, published by Deseret Book Company. She's going to help us think about the theology of religious art, what images can communicate that words sometimes cannot, and what happens when we encounter Christ through a particular artistic representation.
And Mike Houston is the author of the winter 2023 dialogue essay, Racial Innocence and the Christus-based Latter-day Saints Symbol, which examines the LDS Church's use of the Christus statue and the cultural and theological meanings attached to its depiction of a white Christ. His essay argues that religious symbols are never simply neutral images. They carry histories and cultural assumptions with them. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So today we're going to talk about suffering, embodiment, race, artistic tradition, and theology, and what it might mean that Temple Square is giving Latter-day Saints a very different visual encounter with Jesus than the ones we have seen before. So Jenny, let's start by simply looking at these statues. What do you notice about the way these artists have chosen to depict Christ? His posture, facial expression, body, physical signs of suffering that might be easy for an ordinary viewer to miss?
Well, I love that you're starting with that question. As an art historian, I always want to start with looking at the art and just spending a lot of time thinking about what message is being conveyed through the art itself and the formal elements in the art. So I think it's important to keep in mind these two sculptures are part of a larger project of a dozen sculptures that are being put in around Temple Square as part of the renovation there. And all of them, I believe, deal with Jesus either in the New Testament or moments of restoration, like the first vision. As far as I know, I don't think there's anything from the Book of Mormon portrayed in these statues, which is itself an interesting choice to focus on those more universally accessible moments of Jesus's mortal ministry in the New Testament. And then, so let's just look at these two. The Carrying the Cross by Michael Hall. He is such a fantastic neoclassical figurative sculptor. I think really a master of the craft of portraying human anatomy in sculpture. So, but some of the things you were mentioning about the posture here of Christ, we see the way he's holding the cross with these claw-like hands. We see the taut muscles straining, the crouched posture as the cross bears down, the weight of it. You feel the heaviness, the weight of it as it bears down on him. The musculature of the figure is really interesting and not something we typically pay a lot of attention to in Latter-day Saint religious art. And so I think that's interesting that Michael Hall is sort of privileging that aspect of the art. And then at his feet, there are actually little drops of blood that you have to get right up to the sculpture to see. So, you know, maybe referencing what's already happened in Gethsemane. He also has this crown of thorns on his head, so maybe that as well contributing. And then the other one in Gethsemane by the Hunts. This one, you know, you just his facial expression. Clearly, he's in agony. He's kneeling. The hand gesture is kind of interesting to me, and it's hard. I haven't been able to see this in person, and it's hard to tell from some of the photographs exactly what's happening, but this hand up here simultaneously looks like a gesture of agony, but also maybe a gesture of prayer. Sometimes in older art, we see this kind of hands raised as a kind of a indication that the figure is praying. So I think it's probably tying into both of those symbols. I do just have to mention the question of like the way these figures are dressed. And this was something we talked about a lot in the Picturing Christ book that you mentioned. My co-author, Matthew Gray, who's a professor at BYU, he talked a lot about what men in Jesus's day would have worn. Also what they would have looked like, right? But I think a lot of the long robes, the shawl, the head covering over the head, Matthew Gray points out that those are not typical for first century Jewish men in Roman Palestine, although we have a long tradition of seeing that kind of costuming in Western Christian art and Latter-day Saint art, it's not actually probably historical. That's just a little something to point out.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, thank you. Yeah, thanks for that great introduction to you know, the art itself and what these images mean. So I'd like all four of us to talk a little bit about, this question of suffering, the suffering Christ. So the LDS Church has historically tended to emphasize the resurrected, triumphant Christ, particularly through the Christus. These new statues give us Christ in agony. I mean, you talked about the even drops of blood at the base of the statue, which I hadn't been aware of before. These are set in Gethsemane and carrying the cross. So Caroline and I disagree about the value of this kind of art. So I'd like to hear from you. What is the value, if any, or portraying a suffering Christ? And I'll just give myself away at the beginning and say, I love these statues and see a lot of value in it. And I'm really happy with these new statues, including these two of Christ in agony. And Caroline, why don't you share your thoughts, and then we'll hear from our guests.
Yeah, I did not have as positive a reaction, particularly to the statue with Christ carrying the cross. And that is due to a number of reasons, but some of it is simply theological. Like, I don't love to be reminded of a Father God who would allow / require / approve of a beloved child getting tortured for the sake of other children. That to me is troubling. And I know that's like a problem with theology, maybe, you know, more than just this representation, but having it represented, having the torture represented, this very troubling thing. It's just that's just not the Jesus and part of the Jesus story that I want to be thinking about and that I want to focus on. I also think it's problematic for images to be glorifying the suffering of innocent people. This is a depiction of state violence against an innocent man. And if the message was like, this is terrible, let's stop state violence against innocent people, then that could be powerful and moving. But I don't think that's the purpose of that particular statue with Jesus kind of in agony carrying this cross. So I think, you know, there, and also just, you know, again, this goes to some of the theology, just vicarious torture is just not, it's not my thing. And I don't want to look at it. And this goes to, I mean, I know some womanist theologians who really also have trouble with this idea of one man, you know, bearing the cost, kind of being the surrogate for all these other people. And of course, this is because Black women in their history were forced to be surrogates all the time for white women, for, you know, for other people, bearing children that they didn't want to bear, and kind of suffering in this way in the place of others. And so those are just a few reasons why that particular image of the cross, Jesus carrying the cross, is just one that does not resonate with me. How about you, Margaret?
Well, I want to hear from our guests, but I guess I'll just give my short response, which is I don't think you need to believe that God needed torture in order for Christ's suffering to be theologically meaningful. So there's lots of atonement theories out there that would reframe why Christ suffered rather than the Christ sort of taking on other people's sin that God is demanding this punishment. So not that the church has done a great job in helping people understand those other kinds of atonement theories. So I take your point on that. But for me personally, I can see the atonement as less about why did God require this to what does God do with human violence. And the crucifixion can be understood as humanity doing its worst to Jesus, while God responds to that violence with resurrection rather than retaliation. And I think James Cone is really useful there, because for Cone, the crucified Christ matters because God is in solidarity with the crucified and with the suffering. And so the question isn't why would God torture Jesus, but where is God when human beings are being tortured and killed? Because violence is real and is a part of mortality. Okay, so I really want to hear from Jenny and Mike on this.
Mike, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first, because I feel like what I'm going to say is going to build off what Carolyn and Margaret said anyway. So first of all, I actually, the image of Christ carrying the cross is a striking image. It actually reminds me a little bit of El Greco and the sort of like twisty bodies that he does. But I love him, so I maybe have a little bit of bias towards a sculpture that kind of reminds me of that. I think the core question comes down ultimately to what we do with the image, how we treat it. And I think that's what both of you are getting at. If the image is used to reinforce, you know, to name it specifically, like a penal substitutionary model of atonement theory, where the idea is, look at what you made Jesus go through, you better feel bad or else it was wasted. It's not good in my view. I do think, though, there are lots of options in atonement theory that allow you to move beyond that. Like you pointed to James Cone, the liberation theorist, I think do a really interesting job with talking about God choosing sides, being willing to join in solidarity. I think Elizabeth A. Johnson, one of my favorite theologians, she's taken that even a step further and talks about the idea that Jesus wasn't required to be killed, but rather in the act of in the act of suffering, enters into solidarity with all things that die, because she notes that the creation process itself is filled with death. That's how it works, is things are born and then die and then evolve out. And so, like, what happens to the bear and the deer and the bat? And she says the atonement is as much for them as it is for anybody else, which I find to be a really touching idea. But all of this gets to the point that these images aren't neutral. There's no just sort of like, they don't have an inherent meaning. We layer meaning on top of them. And I think absent the church doing creative theological work, which heretofore it's not really been interested in, it's mostly just accepted these, the penal substitutionary model is from the Middle Age theory. It's mostly just absorbed that really unquestionably. And in that view, I think there is the potential for those images to not have the kind of impact that they intended them to have. I also think, Jenny, your point about them being entirely New Testament images is a very interesting one, because there is a homogenization-y feeling thing that's happening with some of the unique parts of the LDS approach to Christianity being de-emphasized over time. And there's an increasing open arms to things that, when I was a kid, like praise music, were really kind of seen as on the margins and really not actually acceptable. And I think images of the tortured Jesus fall into that camp. Like they weren't really okay. And so I really do think this is an interesting trend to watch the church socially try to interact with the world. That was a lot. I'll stop there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is definitely some kind of, it does definitely is feels like some kind of artistic outreach to mainstream Christianity for sure. Yeah, that's a great point. Jenny.
Okay, I have a couple of thoughts. I want to first just, Caroline brought something to my mind with her comment about state violence that I wanted to respond to. I think that was a great point. And I listened to a video interview with the sculptor, Michael Hall, and he actually kind of talked about that there is a Roman soldier figure. So behind Christ carrying the cross, there are two women, a Jewish woman and a Roman woman, and then a Roman soldier. And he talked about how he decided to take the helmet off the Roman soldier and have the helmet put down as sort of a symbol of the Roman soldier having this moment of realization that this is an innocent person being tortured by the state, and that he disagreed, whether or not he believes Jesus is the Christ, he feels like what's happening is not just. So I think that's interesting. He the sculptor himself had that kind of question about that and tried to answer that a little bit there. In terms of the larger question, I liked what you all were saying about this sort of transactional kind of sacrifice idea of atonement and how maybe that doesn't quite capture everything we might want to believe or do believe in the atonement. I really love Marilyn Robinson's approach to these kinds of questions, where she talks about how it's bigger than that. It's bigger than just a transactional sacrifice, but it's this larger kind of incredible and unique display of love from God to show this, what she calls divine restraint, where he was God and all powerful, but also restrained himself to be crucified for us. And it shows God's love for humankind, that humans matter, that God values people, and God responds to human suffering, that Jesus himself came down as the lowliest of people, and and suffered the way that so many people have suffered. And I think that's a really, I mean, at least Marilynne Robinson talks about how that's a kind of beautiful way that God shows his response to human suffering and his loyalty and love for humankind. So all that being said, I like looking at this Michael Hall sculpture with those thoughts in mind of this moment being an incredible witness of God's love for us.
Well, thank you. I actually love all of those perspectives, and hope that maybe as the church uses this art, that it also engages with some of the complex theology behind it, because I think that would do a lot to address some of the concerns that Caroline laid out that I think are really valid here. Okay, so to shift just a little bit, Mike, I want to talk about your dialogue essay and how it connects to some of these new statues. So your essay is centrally concerned with the cultural significance of a white marble Christ. So could you give us just a quick summary of the argument in that paper? And then I'd love to hear what you think happens to our understanding of Christ when the church's public visual vocabulary expands from the white marble to these bronze figures. And does the move to bronze alter the racial symbolism at all?
Yeah, so the argument is, very briefly, is happens in three sort of quick steps. The first is a discussion of the Christus, which is a beautiful statue. I mean, it really is gorgeous. And it depicts a Jesus with very classical features, a thin nose, long flowy hair, a parted beard. I mean, it is a Jesus that looks white. I mean, it's a white Jesus. It's based on a white body. Then what I suggest is that in privileging that particular image without acknowledging the racial component, the church has moved into what is called racial innocence, racial ignorance. They've intentionally not noticed the race. And what they've done in the process of intentionally not noticing is you take race out of the category of eternalized characteristic and move it into something that doesn't matter. And so a really good example here is gender. In the proclamation, we say, you know, gender as an essential, eternal characteristic. And so what that means is that your experience as a female and my experience as a male is not just an earthly experience, but is an eternal experience that has eternal significance. Without acknowledging or by eternalizing race through a white image, but then not acknowledging it, what they've done is essentially said race is a meaningless category for eternal growth. Whether you're white or black or whatever, it doesn't matter in the end, because in the end, we're all going to be non-racial. And then that non-racial image is represented by a white body. And that's that process of racial innocence, I suggest, is damaging, because we've elided all of the associated dynamics of race, which collide with our institution in some pretty difficult ways, but also collide with people's real lives. And we end up in a space where race doesn't matter, or at least doesn't matter in the eternal world that we imagine. And so the question then becomes, do these new images help? And I think the answer is probably completely unsatisfactory, like yes and no. Like, on the one hand, it is valuable to have multiple images of Jesus. Like, it is good that we're starting to expand the visual vocabulary, and that in some of these paintings and sculptures, Jesus doesn't look like a large statuesque Greco-Roman dominant male, right? But I think that only matters to the degree that we acknowledge the racial component of Jesus's person, that Jesus was a male first century Jew living in a Roman occupied area, and that those demographic characteristics are meaningful. And until we can really sort of highlight that they matter, the visual vocabulary just becomes more, I think we flatten it. It's like, oh, look, here's one image of this and one image of that, and they look a little different. Maybe he's even a little more Jewish in one, but we don't, but the significance of that doesn't matter. And I think that in the end, ultimately hurts our theology, because we are a global church with people from all across the world. And to pretend that racial dynamics are a trivial part of our eternal growth, I think ignores a huge, maybe the second largest component of people's lives beside gender identification. And so I do think it's like a yes, but no answer.
Jenny, I'd love to hear your response to that.
Yeah, no, that was interesting. From what I've researched in my art historical research on early Latter-day Saint art and 20th century Latter-day Saint art, I would say I might disagree with some of the assumptions underlying what Mike was saying, just especially with the idea that the Christus statue was chosen as the logo, particularly because it represented white as a category to stand in for all races. I think there are probably a lot of other factors at play of why the Christus has been embraced for so long among Latter-day Saints and their leaders. Importantly, among them, just a sort of mid-20th century idea of trying to show that Latter-day Saints are culturally literate and that they know what European high fine art looks like, and that can be part of our identity too, right? For so long, Latter-day Saints have dealt with the kind of narrative, right, that they're backwards or not sophisticated, not cultured. And by adopting high art from classical, neoclassical artists in Europe, they're saying, oh, well, we actually do have good art and we do have culture and we can be like that too. And then there's just, I mean, there's the whole European heritage of that kind of Western, Northern European, white-looking Jesus, which goes, you know, obviously back well before Latter-day Saints adopted that that history into their own visual canon. You know, and part of it too is just having symbols in art that people can read. A move away from any traditional symbol to something different takes some time, because people just have to learn the language of what it is you're trying to say with the symbols. And that I see that happening a little bit with some, as Mike pointed out, some different types of portrayals of Jesus, and some look a little more Jewish or right, or some have more cultural markers. But ultimately the viewer has to know that it's Jesus. So how do they know that it's Jesus if you're not using a cross? Right, or if you're not using some maybe more traditional Christian imagery, how do you show that it's Jesus unless you have this kind of facial type, right? And so that's tricky. It's tricky for that to change, and it takes some time for it to change.
Jenny, do you see a future in which it will change within our LDS art and especially sanctioned art by the church? Do you see a move towards a more, you know, Jesuses that are of like clearly of color?
I mean, this last year at BYU, they installed on BYU campus a painting by Eternity Stovall of a Black Jesus. I thought that was an incredible step. You know, in terms of the actual approved foyer artwork list, that list continues to be updated and changed. Since they announced it in 2020, I think they've added 18 new pieces and retired some of the others. And most of the new pieces show Jesus in a slightly different way, either a little more of an attempt to be a historical Jesus of Nazareth, or just less European looking, like brown eyes instead of blue eyes, or, you know, a little darker skin, darker hair, a little less Western looking. And then I've also seen the addition of more diverse figures around Christ. And maybe that's one way they're trying to get at it, to be more inclusive in the visual, is to include a greater variety of ethnic and cultural looks among the people with Christ.
Mm-hmm. Now going back to those two bronze statues that we started with, and this is for you again, Jenny. So these statues in Temple Square, these are not just images inside a museum or a book. They're like these large sculptures placed in this public sacred landscape. And I was wondering if you could talk to us about how the physical encounter with a three-dimensional suffering body changes the experience, maybe compared to seeing a painting of the crucifixion or an image of Christ in a church publication.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Certainly, I think you're right that different types of media can elicit a different response in the viewer. I think by having a whole sculpture garden of 12 sculptures, it does encourage the idea of a sacred space that a person can walk through. These figures are meant to be viewed in the round, right? So they're three-dimensional. There's space to walk around them, to look at them from different angles, to have the image reveal itself to you in different ways as you move around it. And that also creates a different kind of interaction between the viewer and the piece, especially because they're, I'm not sure, but they seem to be almost life-size or even larger than life-size in some of them. So it might make, or it might have the effect of making the viewer feel like the moment being depicted is more immediately present to them, that they can participate in it somehow. I think they're certainly meant to create, through this whole space, a feeling of reverence, and awe. I'm excited to walk through it once it's all. I know there's two more statues still coming.
Mm-hmm. When I was thinking about this issue, particularly with this comparison that we've been talking about with the marble to bronze, it just seems to me like bronze has a very different embodied experience to me, and maybe you disagree, but bronze to me, just like marble, feels sort of like idealization and timelessness and sort of classical perfection, and bronze to me feels like heavier, earthier, more bodily, more sort of materially present. And so to have these sculptures in bronze to me feels, it particularly of like Christ's New Testament life, a not resurrected Christ, but like a Christ on earth. I think it is, I don't know, I think there is something to that, like that statue versus painting on a wall experience.
Margaret, I love that. And I just want to add, that makes me think they're, of all of these statues, they are all very earthbound moments, right? It's not Jesus enthroned in heaven.
Yeah.
It's not second coming in the clouds. These are earthly moments with humans.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah. I think if I could add on to that, I think building on that point, I think, so partly, one of the fun things about looking at art is actually you end up learning a lot more about yourself sometimes in the art and what you, so, you know, I actually learned something about you, Margaret, in the way that you approach Jesus by the way that you understand the statues, right, as a more bodily, embodied, grounded figure. But I do think the images which feel a little more earthy are theologically positive, because we spent a lot of time with this very, very high Christology, and we're really good at it, but we miss the entire, like, the low part of Jesus. And so by bringing that low part forward, I do think there is it expands not just our visual repertoire, but like our theological discussions can open just a little bit more. I do think having sort of the very large, not ominous, that's probably the part, but very large statue of a resurrected classical Jesus always looming in the background does something. But I appreciate the fact that there is a more embodied depiction, which I hope leads to more discussions of embodied theology, which then I think really does drive us towards a deeper understanding of atonement and atonement theory. So I think this is it's a really good move for the church, aside from public relations, if we use it. I mean, and that's always it always comes back to, if we use it, if we embrace the bodiliness, the humanness of it, I think it can be really powerful. If it just becomes like the place you go when relatives are visiting because it's nice, then it's not going to have that kind of impact.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think your earlier point of the specificity of Christ's body being so crucial, you know, these statues and the embodiment of it, you know, it might lead more towards what you're describing, for that need of acknowledging, you know, that who Christ specifically was is important. But again, as you were saying, it just depends on how we use the art.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a great discussion. I want to wrap up by asking you both to just look ahead. So if Temple Square is becoming a place where Latter-day Saints encounter many different visual representations of Christ, what do you hope happens to Latter-day Saint theology as a result? What can art teach us about Jesus that words sometimes can't? And particularly with Mike, I'd like to hear what might make that shift possible theologically that we've been talking about today.
Yeah, maybe I'll go first, because I actually think Jenny's thoughts might be more interesting to wrap us up. So in terms of... I feel like a little bit of a broken record. I mean, in terms of where we might be going, I think it really depends on where we choose to go. The last few general conferences have not been examples of creative theology, I would say, right? It's been a lot of reinforcing sort of the standard lines, trying to encourage people to, you know, obedience and following the rule, like all the stuff that you kind of expect, I think, in general conference. But this, I guess what I struggle with is, I don't know if this new openness is a signal of increased theological creativity, or if it, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but it's going to sound that way, or if it's about reaching out to look like Christians. Mm. Like, it's hard for me to sort of like understand which this is. And maybe that distinction isn't real. Maybe it's all kind of the same, or maybe there's another option that I'm not naming. If this is really just about making us look like the rest of the Christians, then I don't think it's really going to take us anywhere, or we'll just end up, you know, we know where it's going to go. We can look at the Christians that are out there, and that's what we're going to end up looking like. If this is a signal of an increased openness and to theological creativity, I think this is the beginning of what could be a really fruitful time in LDS thinking, where we take these images seriously and we ask the hard questions, like Caroline asked, is it right that God punishes the innocent And we grapple with that, and we look and stare at the result, and we wonder what that means. And then we think about what an embodied theology would look like. And we start worrying more about the suffering that we allow to exist than we worry about whether or not we're going to get to heaven. And I think I would love to see us drive that way. And there are so many smart people who are deeply committed to this tradition that could help shepherd us in that direction. And maybe the art is the toe in the door, and that will get us there. I really hope that's what it does. I hope it opens the door for a more robust, creative, thoughtful, theological maturation that starts to really embrace a more holistic and grounded sense of our place in the world and Jesus's role relative to us.
Well, thank you.
Jenny, how about you?
Mike, I love what you said there. I always say art is a gateway drug to theology, because I think you're exactly right. It feels a little less scary and a little more accessible, but art does do theological work. I know that when Michael Hall presented his proposal to the Temple Art Committee and the presiding bishopric for this sculpture, he originally had Christ actually on the cross. And he thought for sure they just weren't going to accept it at all. But the presiding bishopric, who was Elder Calcet, he loved it, but he said, why don't you just change it to Christ carrying the cross instead? And I think even that is a remarkable shift, that was that idea of the suffering Christ and Christ carrying the cross, almost like a sort of a Stations of the Cross kind of imagery is embraced on Temple Square. In terms of other questions about the sort of like multiplicity or diversity of images, I do see that happening more and more. And I see people being more aware of that, both within church leadership and just among general members. My co-author, Daniel Becerra, who in this Picturing Christ book, he wrote a really powerful final chapter in that book talking about how diversity in art and depictions of Jesus in particular is really important for members of a global church that come from so many different backgrounds. And it's not that white Jesus is bad. It's that if you only see white Jesus, then what does that say to people who don't look like white Jesus, right? And so it's this variety and diversity that is so beautiful and can speak to the varieties of human experience. And as Daniel points out in his chapter, speaks to the incredible depth of the character of Jesus Christ. There are so many ways to think about him as the good shepherd, as the living water, as, you know, the true vine. Like, there's so many ways you could symbolize him and think about him. You couldn't possibly get to all the aspects of his character through one image. So let's have a lot of images, and let's explore the nature of God and our relationship with him through a lot of different kinds of images. And I think that can only add to the richness of our theology and experience.
Thank you so much for both those responses. I loved them. With that, we have to wrap up this episode. Thank you to Jenny Champeau and Mike Houston for helping us to think more deeply about what the church's choice of new religious iconography means, what we gain and perhaps what we risk when we put particular images of Christ at the center of our religious spaces, and to think about what all of us are going to do with them. Thank you for listening to Dialogue Out Loud. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and visit dialoguejournal.com for more conversations and writing about Mormon thought and culture. I'm Margaret Olson Hemming with Caroline Klein. Thank you for listening.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.